After an alleged chemical weapons attack by the Syrian regime, the question of a military response seems not one of if, but when. What are the options? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Politics Day, we look at the international response to alleged chemical attacks in Syria and the possible political repercussions of any military response. Also, President Obama is expected to highlight the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s economic agenda as he marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington today. Our analysts to discuss these and other political developments, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Join our discussion for this Politics Day after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day Wednesday has arrived, and our guests, our analysts in the studio, Tim Hagel in Iowa City, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Tim, welcome back.
Hey there.
Also with us, Wayne Moyer, joining us by phone, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hello to you, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. We want to roughly break down the show into two halves today. We'll throw in some other things, no doubt. But the first half, we want to address the situation in Syria. And in the second half, we want to reflect on this momentous day. By the way, we'll have live coverage of speeches, commemoration of the March on Washington, the 50th anniversary, beginning at 1 o'clock today. That will take the place of Here and Now coverage, live coverage from NPR following this program. In the second part of our program, when we do talk about Martin Luther King's legacy, his speech given at that event, we want to ask you, and you can be thinking about it right now, or email us, or get in touch with our Facebook page, six words or less, what do you think is the part of Martin Luther King's dream still left unfulfilled, if you think there is one? Give us six words or less. What part of the I Have a Dream speech is left unfulfilled 50 years after that speech? First, as I mentioned, we want to address Syria. We've heard that in our news as well in the last few days. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon today urged the international community to give peace a chance in Syria. He called for allowing UN weapons inspectors to do their work and for using all means possible to get the two sides back to the negotiating table. But he also says the UN Security Council must not be silent as the crisis deepens.
Most of all, the Security Council of the United Nations must uphold its responsibilities, moral and political responsibilities, under the Charter of the United Nations. Syria is the biggest challenge of war and peace in the world today. The body entrusted with maintaining international peace and security cannot be missing in action. The Council must at last find the unity to act. It must use its authority for peace. The war has created a lost generation of children and young people. Mothers, farmers, families face worsening prospects by the day. The Syrian people deserve solutions, not silence. Our common humanity demands that all do their utmost to end this tragedy now.
Now, we heard earlier this week Secretary of State John Kerry. That by the way, Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, he spoke at the Great Hall of Justice at the Peace Palace in The Hague. That's marking its 100th anniversary. This week, Secretary of State John Kerry calling the use of chemical weapons in Syria a moral obscenity. And he laid blame for the attack squarely at the feet of the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad.
The indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, the killing of women and children and innocent bystanders by chemical weapons is a moral obscenity. By any standard, it is inexcusable, and despite the excuses and equivocations that some have manufactured, it is undeniable.
Secretary of State John Kerry. For its part, the Syrian government, the Assad regime, says the gas attack was staged by the rebels in order to provoke Western military intervention. Let's talk about this, Wayne Moyer. tell us a little bit about how close you see we are to military action. What do you see? What indications do you see about where we are? How close? What are we waiting for if that's to happen?
I think we're very close, probably days away, three or four, something in that range. And the indications of this are all the announcements that we've seen in various news media about military preparation, ships moving to the eastern Mediterranean, preparations to use cruise missiles, et cetera. If we weren't close, we wouldn't have made those announcements. As to what the administration is waiting for, I suspect it is building a coalition, getting a sufficiently large number of other nations that will agree with the U.S. in terms of exactly what to do. The one thing I'm sure the administration doesn't want to do is to do this alone or with only a very small number of other countries helping us.
River to River listeners, what do you think? Do you think the U.S. and its international partners should strike Syria at this point? 1-866-780-9100. Do you think that would be effective, some sort of strike in preventing another chemical attack, or would that escalate the conflict in the region? Should we just stay out of the conflict altogether? Give us your view. 1-866-780-9100. Questions, of course, welcome as well. 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. I suspect that that's right. The president and his team getting as many countries, as many world leaders on board here. Yesterday, the leaders of the Arab world blamed the Syrian government for the chemical weapons attack, but declined to back a retaliatory military strike. Now, doesn't this, Wayne, leave President Obama without the broad support he had, for instance, with the last military intervention in the Middle East, Libya, in 2011?
Well, he will not get direct support from most of the Arab governments because he won't have very much public support in those countries. But I don't think he'll get much opposition from most of the other countries as well. This is seen in many of these countries as a struggle between Iran on one hand, Syria as a surrogate of Iran, and the Sunni nations. And there's very little support for Assad in these countries. So I suspect that if Obama goes in, there won't be public support from these leaders, but there will not be very much opposition either.
Now, this week we have, one of the strongest critics, let's turn to the domestic side of this, one of the strongest critics of U.S. inaction thus far on Syria. We've heard Arizona Republican Senator John McCain. This morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe, Senator McCain said the U.S. needs to intervene to prevent the crisis from worsening.
This is turned into a regional conflict. There is more violence in Iraq than there's been since 2008. Jordan is terribly destabilized by these refugee inflows. Lebanon is destabilized. The whole area, this conflict is spreading, and you will see effects of that, including one of the first, we are seeing the increase in the price of oil. This conflict cannot be contained within Syria, and we have to understand that, and that's why we've got to help these people get rid of Bashar Assad, get the momentum back on their side.
John McCain this morning on MSNBC. Tim Hagel, this gives us a chance to talk a little bit about what has been going on, as far as you can tell, about the decision-making process of the president in relation to the Congress. When the president takes an action like this, a military action like this, what paces does a president have to go through? What communication with Congress? Does he need approval from Congress, merely consultation? Or is that a gray area?
It's a very gray area. And that's where you see a lot of the argument. Some people are coming out very strongly suggesting that President Obama needs congressional approval. And what they're thinking of course, is the declaration of war. But, of course, military action can occur without there being an actual declaration of war. This has happened in the past. And as much as members of Congress want to be consulted, they don't have to be in many instances. And this has been the case not only for several actions that President Obama has taken, but presidents before him going back many years. It's still probably politically a good idea to consult Congress. President Bush did before going into Iraq. You had the vote that Congress took. But politically, that may not be something that Obama wants to do, because a lot of those votes that members of Congress took, particularly Democrats that voted in favor of the Iraq war, came back to haunt them later on. And even though President Obama is not running for re-election again, we do have the 2014 midterm elections coming up, and that would certainly put a lot of Democrats on the spot if they ended up voting for another war. They also don't want to vote against the president, so the best thing is not to have a vote.
We heard the voice of John McCain there, one of the harshest critics of U.S. inaction, critic of President Obama in this case. I wonder, he is one Republican voice, albeit a leading Republican voice. Does the question of how to respond to Syria get reflected in party politics? Is this one of those down the aisle ones, or is there a mix out there, Tim?
It's a real mix. You have some Democrats who have opposed Bush's actions that will still oppose Obama's actions militaristically, maybe not as vocally as they had with President Bush, but still will oppose it, and others that may be willing to say, well, you know, Obama has a better position. Syria isn't the same thing as Iraq, and so therefore it's justified. You'll have some Republicans that will oppose it for political reasons, but other Republicans might oppose it, saying, "Well, look, we're not against going to taking military action in all circumstances. We're certainly in favor of it under proper situation, but we need to feel confident that whatever's going to take place is going to be effective and it has a strategic purpose. It's not just symbolic, or it's not going to, as you indicated earlier, or suggested as a possible concern, that it's going to make things worse, and that's been raised too."
Okay, what do you think, River to River listeners? Do you think the U.S. and its international partners should strike Syria? 1-866-780-9100. What's going through your mind as you hear the various reports out of Washington, out of the rest of the world, out of Syria? Larry is in Cedar Falls. Hi, Larry.
Good morning, or afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question is this a point where the United States could give up some excessive responsibility for managing things like this and make the UN bite the bullet? Certainly we could be a part of any efforts to make a difference there, and it's excruciating to watch what's going on and right. Knowing we're not acting. But if Russia and China are going to hold out on some joint effort by the UN, let them be the ones carrying the burden that we can't act because they won't take their responsibility.
Okay, Larry, thank you for that question. Let's go to Wayne on that. Why can't we play by the UN's rules? Do we have to change the rules if it doesn't go our way?
I agree that the UN is not, because of the Russian veto in the Security Council, is going to be able to do anything. The problem here, as I see it, Obama has said previously he will not tolerate nuclear weapons in Iran, and he will not tolerate chemical warfare, the Assad regime using chemical warfare in Syria. If Obama does not respond in Syria, his credibility in terms of being able to do anything in terms of the Iranian nuclear weapon will disappear. And so he has to, in terms of credibility, his ability to make threats and promises in terms of what the United States will do depends on his ability to take action in Syria. Now, there are two problems with this. One, he could do too little, and Assad will see this as a victory. Two, he can do too much, and this whole situation escalates. So there are risks here, but there are risks either way. We need long-term stability in the Middle East. I can't see us having it if the U.S. doesn't have credibility. And so I think that's, for me, the critical issue here.
It's important to note Britain has drafted a resolution condemning the chemical weapons attack by Assad and authorizing necessary measures to protect civilians. That announced by Prime Minister David Cameron's office. I believe that will be put forward at a meeting of the five permanent members of the Security Council today, later in New York. Larry in Cedar Falls, thank you for your question about the UN. Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's go to Patrick in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Patrick. Your concern, your question, your view?
Well, once again, along the lines of the UN question, you probably answered this. But we have sold lots of armament to the Middle East, to nations that have a vested interest in seeing this not happen, that are immediately in the area. They have some very advanced armament from us. One would wonder why there isn't action from those people dealing with their own immediate crisis with those arms. At some point, when will they step up? Because, as the previous caller mentioned, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. At some point, when do we pressure them to make the incursion rather than us be surrogate?
Okay, Patrick.
It's logical to ask.
Patrick, thank you very much. That question from Cedar Rapids to Wayne.
Well, in terms of the military assistance from other nations, clearly Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf states are shipping arms to the rebels and sustaining the opposition to the Assad regime. I'm not sure that even with the arms that they have, that they could launch a direct military strike on Syria. Syria has very substantial, for instance, anti-aircraft capabilities. It's getting a lot of support from Iran. It's getting a lot of support from Russia. And so I'm not sure that the other countries have the direct ability to take military action, although they support the rebel cause.
Tim Hagel, do you want to...
Yeah, let me take a slightly different tack than what Wayne has on the last two questions, and that is that both callers basically saying, well, what if the UN doesn't act? What if the Arab countries don't act? Let them, you know, we can just sit on the sidelines saying let them solve their own problems. The problem that for us in that respect is that if they don't act, UN or the other Arab countries, all of a sudden what – and maybe this is undercharacterizing it, but maybe this is considered just a civil war at this point, becomes a conflagration in the whole area. And then our interests are hurt more. And so for us, it's that choice between, well, we don't want to get involved now, but if we don't get involved now, it's going to be much worse and much more involved later on. And so that's kind of where we've been at and where we're at right now.
Patrick, thank you for your call from Cedar Rapids. Let's move to Marshall in Iowa City. Marshall, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing well. What's on your mind?
I had a question regarding kind of, I think someone mentioned it yesterday, mission creep. At what point do we have a plan? Are we going to hit facilities that make chemical weapons? Do we know where those are? And if the conflict escalates, you mentioned Syria does have really effective anti-aircraft weaponry. So are we going to have to fly Americans in jets, you know, maybe F-22s, I don't know, to take out their military? Or at what point do we stop? At what point is the mission accomplished, I guess the cliche goes.
There you go. What is the path from here on? What can you see if there is some sort of strike? Your thoughts on that, Wayne?
Well, I mean, it's a really wonderful question because there's a great deal of uncertainty in terms of what will happen. My sense is, and from what I read in the newspapers, that what we will strike is not the chemical weapons themselves or facilities themselves, because that might release a lot of poisonous gas, which would all sorts of casualties, civilian casualties, but to strike at the forces that deliver chemical weapons to make it harder for Syria to deliver chemical weapons in the future. Will the Syrians respond? It's a good question. We do know that Israel has struck Syria several times, and Syria has not responded to Israel. Israel destroyed building a nuclear site. Syria is fully engaged fighting the rebels now. If it gets involved and escalates this and gets involved in a war with the United States, it seems to me that runs the risk of taking them beyond their capabilities and making them even more excessively dependent on Iran and Russia than they are now.
Mm-hmm. We heard in our news Jordan not allowing a launch of attack from its soil, fearing a retaliation. What about Wayne talked about some more of the neighbors in that region that have concerns. Who is most worried? And we haven't really touched on Israel yet, have we?
No, we haven't. Israel is obviously very concerned about this. I gather there's been a run on gas masks in Israel. The best I know about Israel calculations is that Israel does not think, for I think many of the same reasons I said, that Syria would respond directly to Israel. Israel is terribly concerned about Iran and not doing anything and thus infringing on Obama's credibility with regard to Iran, I think, would be looked at badly in Israel. On the other side, Turkey is very supportive of action. And we are likely, if the U.S. does launch a military strike, to get overt direct support from Turkey.
To Turkey, on that northern border, you think launching an attack from that from the ground?
I don't think so. I think it's easy enough to do it from this Mediterranean Sea, and my sense is that and all the reports that I've seen is that it'll come from cruise missiles or conceivably from aircraft. The aircraft carriers, I gather, are in the Arabian Sea, but they could still reach Syria. I don't think either Jordan or Turkey are likely to be basis for launching an operation.
Let's get a quick question in before the break from Tony in Des Moines. Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Yes, we're hearing you, Tony. Go ahead, please. We've not much time before the break.
Sure. Very quickly, I'm not sure if this is possible, but is there some way that we can indict Assad through some international court for using those chemical weapons and thereby get UN support? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony from Des Moines. Wayne, could you tackle
that? Well, I suspect that he will be indicted, but it will take time on the International Criminal Court. As the president of Sudan has been indicted in the past. But the problem there will be getting custody of him. It's very hard to get a person who is actually in power into court. But I would suspect that down the pike, we are going to see an indictment.
Okay, we're going to see an indictment. We want to talk about this more when we come back here. I'm wondering, what aspects have we yet to talk about? We have to talk about public opinion. Do we know what the U.S. public feels about action in Syria, Tim Hagel?
Not very enthusiastic, and this has been the case for a number of potential military actions. Generally, the public is not in favor of countries using chemical weapons, but then at the same token don't want to get involved. There's a certain fatigue from both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and so they also want to see a clear path, which we've already talked about. And that's the thing that's sort of missing at this point is, well, okay, if you're going to engage in military action, what is your goal? What is it that you are going to do so that you don't have, as the caller indicated, mission creep?
Okay, we want to talk about that. What possible scenarios do you see regarding Syria? I want to put that to our political analysts when we come back. Wayne Moyer, Tim Hagel with us this week. We also want to get you onto the conversation. We're going to continue this a little bit into the second half, talking about what looks like an inevitable strike against Syria for the alleged chemical attacks in the coming days. What are your thoughts on that? What are your questions? 1-866-780-9100. Then we're going to move on to this historic day, the look back at the 50th anniversary on the March on Washington. What do you think still needs to be achieved in terms of civil rights in this country? We're asking you for 6 words or less. What part of Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream is left unfulfilled? 1-866-780-9100. We're on Facebook. Tweet us at IPR Talk or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. Glad to have you on board midstream, River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're continuing to talk for a few more minutes about the situation in Syria and the alleged chemical weapons attack by the Syrian regime. The question of the response seems to be a military response, not of if, but when. And we're looking at what are options, what is the political fallout, what are the political calculations being made by not only the U.S. government, but also governments around the country. And we want to hear what's on your mind. 1-866-780-9100. Now, as several members of President Obama's team have said, the president is considering all options as they relate to Syria. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says U.S. forces are ready, but President Obama has repeatedly demonstrated reluctance to involve the U.S. in another conflict in the Middle East. Here he is in an interview with CNN last week.
You know, sometimes what we've seen is that folks will call for immediate action, jumping into stuff that does not turn out well, gets us mired in very difficult situations, can result in us being drawn in to very expensive, difficult, costly interventions that actually breed more resentment in the region.
President Obama speaking last week. Tim Hagel, our analyst today, along with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Tim and Wayne, let's go to our callers and continue this discussion for a few more minutes. Brian in Cedar Rapids, hi. Your thoughts, your concerns?
Well, my concern is that we're looking at a conflict between two organizations or an administration and a group of rebels. And for the most part, the administration that's currently in power with Assad has stated its resentment and its disdain towards the United States and its government for its actions in the region, as well as the rebels are being backed by terrorist organization like Hezbollah or, you know, Al-Qaeda. So really what it comes down to, if we intervene in this, we're basically going to the aid of our enemy either way. Mm-hmm. So we really have no dog in this fight.
So what would you advise the president to do?
I would airdrop firearms in the country and let them kill themselves off. It's ridiculous to get involved in another conflict where the only thing we're going to do, win or lose, or whoever we aid, we're going to be resented for it. They're still going to want to kill Americans.
Okay, Brian in Cedar Rapids, thanks for your input. Talk about that, Wayne, a little bit, because if the Assad regime would fall, they don't show any sign of it. In fact, it looks like up to this point it's been going Assad's way. But remove Assad from the equation, you don't necessarily have a friendly regime to the United States, do you?
Yeah, I would agree. There are no good guys in this struggle. But I do think it makes a difference that chemical weapons were used. Chemical weapons were last used massively in World War I. The casualties and the long-term effects of that were so great that the world virtually banned them by treaty in the mid-1920s. And neither the Nazis nor the Japanese or anybody else used them in World War II. Yeah. Now, yes, Saddam Hussein used them once against the Kurds in his country, and the U.S. was involved in that, unfortunately. But to get the message out that the use of chemical weapons is tolerable does, to me, make a difference here between the two sides. And it's important that action be taken, that there be some sort of punishment for the use of these things.
But what?
So I guess the question, the frustration we heard from Cedar Rapids was that you're saying, Wayne, that we have to realize, even though Syria is on the other side of the world, what goes on there has direct relevance to us.
Well, yes, and if he gets away with using chemical weapons now, he's probably going to use them more. If he uses them successfully, won't other leaders in other parts of the world think that they can use chemical weapons successfully?
Okay. Let's take Ed in Des Moines, our last caller on Syria, before we move on to the commemoration going on to Washington. Ed in Des Moines, hi.
Hi. Well, it seems to me for the last decade we've put two wars on a credit card. The Pentagon is under a sequestration for its budget. The Treasury Department tells us we're within weeks of becoming insolvent as a nation, and yet we want to go off on another military adventure of billions of dollars. Shouldn't the president first go to Congress and say, hey, give me a war tax to pay for this first? You know, perhaps have someone like John McCain lead the effort there to put that tax into effect so that the American people could be brought in to pay for this adventure first.
Ed, thank you for that point from Des Moines. Let's have Tim Hagel react to that, please.
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting idea, and that's certainly one of the things that's been a criticism of the Bush, the way he handled it, and Iraq and Afghanistan, putting on the credit cards, a kind of a common phrasing of that. We haven't really been ever in a position where you said, well, okay, we're going to pay for this in advance, whether it's a war tax or something else. Of course, you do have to pay for those debts, although we do have a pretty big debt. So arguably, we haven't paid for some of this stuff in the past. But again, I don't know that politically that any president, whether it's Obama or anybody else before or after, would want to put it in those particular terms and saying, well, okay, we're going to have a tax, otherwise we're not going to go to war. You're either going to do it or not, and you can find the funds or figure it out later on and be willing often to go into debt. But given the current fiscal considerations, it's an interesting idea, and I'm sure it would certainly put a lot of folks on the spot, particularly ones that may be willing to take military action.
Okay, before we move on, Wayne Moyer, anything left from your side?
Well, the one thing I would say is before Obama is going to be able to get the support of the American people from this, he's going to have to give a speech where he provides some pretty strong evidence of the chemical attack. People still remember before the attack in 2003, the weapons of mass destruction that turned out not to be. Some people even remember the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. So he's got an enormous burden on him to make that case. On the other hand, I think he's got some really strong evidence, and I think he will make that case.
Okay, let's move on to the other big political event of the day. In just a few hours, President Obama will stand in the symbolic shadows of Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln, as a matter of fact, as well. He marked the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. We've been hearing a lot about it over the last few days, so we're asking for you to tell us in six words or less, what do you think is the part of Martin Luther King's dreams left unfulfilled? Six words or less via email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Facebook, you can post something there, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Now, Senator John Lewis was the youngest speaker at that march on Washington 50 years ago in 1963. This weekend, he returned to the podium to address those gathered to commemorate the anniversary, and he urged the nation's young people to engage with today's civil rights challenges.
You cannot stand by. You cannot sit down. You got to stand up. Speak up, speak out, and get in the way. Make some noise. The vote is precious. It is almost sacred. It is the most powerful nonviolent tool we have in a democratic society, and we got to use it. Back in 1963, we hadn't heard of the internet. We didn't have a cellular telephone, my iPad, iPod. But we used what we had to bring about a nonviolent revolution. And I said to all of the young people, you must get out there and push and pull and make America what America should be for all of us. We must say to the Congress, fix the Voting Rights Act. We must say to the Congress, pass comprehensive immigration reform. It doesn't make sense that millions of our people are living in the shadow. Bring them out into the light and set them on a path to citizenship. So hang in there. Keep the faith. I got arrested 40 times during the 60s, beaten, left bloody and unconscious. But I'm not tired. I'm not weary. I'm not prepared to sit down and give up. I am ready to fight and continue to fight, and you must fight.
Senator John Lewis, the youngest speaker at the March on Washington 50 years ago, speaking this past weekend, returning to the podium with some fiery speech. We want to reach out to you. Six words or less. What part of Martin Luther King's dream is left unfulfilled? We heard some semblance of that, certainly more than six words from John Lewis. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. www.jessicaclemens.org. One of our six words or less, Jessica says, by the content of their character, are her six words. So I thank you for that, Jessica. Still not quite what she wants in terms of judging people by the content of their character. Thank you. It was late in the day, a hot day, not unlike today in Iowa for sure, after that long march and afternoon of speeches about federal legislation, unemployment, and racial and social justice that the Reverend Martin Luther King finally stepped to the lectern in front of that Lincoln Memorial to address that crowd. About 250,000 people. I want to ask each of you, Tim and Wayne, what do you think is the lasting impact of that day and that speech? Tim Hagel.
Well, you know, I don't think at the time as many, despite the number of people that were there and the attention that it got, that it's sort of in retrospect that we saw the importance of it, that it sort of sowed the seeds that as much as the turmoil from the mid to late 60s, the riots that occurred and some of the other stuff that was happening, that, you know, the bigger gains didn't occur until much later. And it still, though, the speech was the one that people were able to kind of hearken back to and sort of see that this is where the seeds were sown. Sown earlier in many respects, too, but this sort of solidified it, and especially that famous phrase, which as reports are indicating now was perhaps thrown in at the last minute, wasn't part of the original speech, but it's for many people the most memorable part. And if you get a chance, there's a 17-minute video that you can find on YouTube in various places. It's well worth watching, and you see some of the other things that King talked about, the economic aspects, the nonviolence, and so forth, as well as then the most memorable Well, I Have a Dream portion.
Wayne, your take on it.
Well, I agree with everything that Tim said, but I think what's particularly important for me is that this whole day helped set the environment that then Lyndon Johnson could use after he came into office just 3 or 4 months later to push movement of, first of all, the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, and even more important, the Voting Rights Bill in 1965. And I think that's made a tremendous difference. But I think without the march in 1963, even with Lyndon Johnson's skills, it would have been more difficult.
Mm-hmm. And just a moment ago, we heard John Lewis, he gave such an elevated speech there. I elevated him to senator when, in fact, he's only a congressman. Sorry for that incorrect statement. Let's go to our phones. Joe is with us in Ames. Joe, you have, I think, a six-word comment on the part of Martin Luther King's dream still left unfulfilled?
Yes, I do. My six words are, racism is still alive and well.
Mm. And also here in Iowa, as a northern state, you think?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that you've encountered recently, within the last few years?
I in the newspapers every day when I hear many of our politicians trying to stop people from voting. It's unconscionable, and it's been expressed openly that they don't want blacks to vote. So racism is alive and well all over the country. Yeah.
Joe and Ames, thank you for your call. Let's go to Craig in Davenport. Hi, Craig.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You have six words for us?
I do, and it actually it goes along with the first email that you would have received, judging a person by the content of their character. And my six words are more of an analytic observation, but knowledge of one's character connotes affinity. And so it's really a matter of, what he meant by not judging by the color of the skin, but the content of the character is looking past the racial issue, but also having a willingness to know an individual or group of individuals that we may consider others. And I think that is still prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Craig, thank you very much for those six words and your comment, Craig, from Davenport. Let's take one more. Let's go to Craig in another Craig. This one in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Craig.
Hi. My six words are world, people, working together.
Okay, those are four. You got two more if you'd like them. That's okay. If you've only got four, it's fine too.
Sure. That's all.
Okay.
Needed.
Greg, very good. Let's talk about how the legacy of Martin Luther King here in the remaining minutes and what he expressed in that speech has been brought into the politics of today. We had one caller make a reference to the Supreme Court decision. We had the case of Trayvon Martin here, too often quoted as having ties back to this. Tim, give us your thoughts there.
Well, obviously, this is can be a very difficult and politically charged area, and that's part of the problem is that people often, as one of the callers indicated, sometimes can't look past the race. And there are a variety of reasons for that. Perhaps it is racism, but sometimes race is injected into things where it really isn't applicable in the sense that people are trying to sort of piggyback on the civil rights movement in ways that perhaps Reverend King didn't intend. And we don't know, and you know, people will invoke his name in various ways, and you're going to get into an argument about whether he would have liked this or not liked something else. But the idea of sort of trying to get past some of these and get to know that person, as the caller indicated, is often a problem. And if you're going to throw in race, and that's part of the thing, is that if you see this a lot of times in politics where Republicans will oppose President Obama because they don't like his policies, but then an often retort that you often hear from some quarters is that, oh, it's because he's of his race. Mm-hmm. When it's not, but once you've thrown that out there, then it becomes part of the process. And so it's difficult to make progress in certain areas.
Tim Hagel, Washington, we know, is so divided in so many issues, so polarized. Are there political divisions when it comes to the way people in this country, politicians of certain political parties, view the legacy of Martin Luther King? Is the division there? Is that a divisive point, that historical legacy, or are we unified there in standing behind his dream?
You know, I'll give you the standard professor answer, which is yes and no.
Okay.
And, you know, in many respects, I think people are unified in sort of the way they see the words and the goals that he's trying to achieve in terms of harmony and racial equality and things like that. The problem comes in the means used to achieve them. And whether it's some particular thing's a good thing or a bad thing, and mentioning the Voting Rights Act and the recent Supreme Court decision is a good example of that, where the court basically said, well, look, you need to readjust your formulas and so fix it. So in that sense, Congress does need to fix it. But other people will say, oh, well, this is an attempt to try to keep black people or other minorities from voting, and that's not what the court had indicated, but that's the interpretation. So then it again injects that racial component into the political side of things, which then makes it more difficult to correct.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moore. Your thoughts on Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream here 50 years after that being uttered?
Yeah, I think one problem that I still see is that it's toxic to talk about race. We're not comfortable having a conversation about race. We talk about other things, but beneath the surface often is race. Now, sometimes there are other things involved besides race, but I wonder if society wouldn't be better off if we could be comfortable actually talking about it, even though this may inflame tensions in some sense. But rather than sort of putting it under the surface and not talking about it directly, it may be worse than if we actually were talking about it directly.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left, and President Obama this afternoon, he's hours away from standing where Martin Luther King Jr. stood 50 years ago, Abraham Lincoln, to mark this 50th anniversary. He says it's a sensitive area. What do you expect from the president this afternoon, Tim Hagel, briefly, and then we'll go to Wayne before we close?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Apparently, and not surprisingly, Martin Luther King is a hero to President Obama. And so that's hopefully will invoke some of the themes that King did. And President Obama's course is usually a good orator. And so we would expect a powerful speech from him under the circumstances, and to try to maybe put us on that path to being able to talk about race in ways that are productive rather than divisive.
Okay, a positive spin on that. What else do you expect, Wayne Moyer?
Well, I suspect he's going to talk about voting rights. And I think he's also going to put big emphasis on economic equality. And can we really deal with racial issues unless we deal with the economic equality issues? And my guess is that that will be a big theme.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he'll do this from a great height, so to speak, figuratively, or will he address the current political issues, the Supreme Court ruling, the fact that the southern states can do things that they couldn't before this ruling happened? Will he tackle those head on, or will he stay above that fray?
My guess is he'll speak from a great height. I could be wrong on that, but try to sound presidential. Try to avoid dividing, being more divisive. Try to bring the American people together. That's my guess.
Final thoughts from you, Tim Hagel.
You know, I think that if he gets into those topics, it mm-hmm. may not be from a great height. It might be more of a middle height kind of a thing, mm-hmm. where if he's going to bring those up, he's probably going to have to get into some of the specifics.
Okay. And we have that coming up, the next few hours of programming here on Iowa Public Radio. We'll be looking forward to that live coverage from NPR on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. That is taking the place of Here and Now. This afternoon, our programming there preempted to bring you that live coverage from NPR. I want to thank you, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, as well as Wayne Moyer Rosenfield, Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, for lending us your expertise, your insights this hour. Tim and Wayne, thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ben.
And I want to tell you, tomorrow on this program, we had the recent release of more secret recordings. Another historical thing. Richard Nixon made those recordings, and some 340 hours were released recently, the last batch of them. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Dennis Goldford at Drake University. He'll share his thoughts on what these new recordings reveal and how we view the Nixon presidency in the past 40 years. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay tuned for live coverage from Washington and NPR.